This is the Rock and Roll Autopsy Podcast.
All right, I'm going to zap her again. Charge up the paddles. Come on, let's go.
Sorry, Doctor.
Hold the compressions.
Clear.
Straight line.
Good evening and welcome to Rock and Roll Autopsy. We are the Forensic Files on your radio dial. My name is Scott. And have we got a great show for you tonight? No, we don't. Damn it! The phone is ringing again. It's the request line. All right, let's pick it up. WRNRA, East of the Rockies. Hey, breather, what's going on, man? You watched Billy Squier's public career suicide and infamous 1980s music video Rock Me Tonight on YouTube? Wow. Imagine voluntarily putting content out into the world for all of humanity to judge and consume while being completely oblivious to how embarrassing, cringeworthy, and poorly executed the end product truly is. Whatever, smartass. Listen, you called the request line. Is there a song you'd like us to perform an autopsy on?
I said,
Rock Me Tonight by Billy Squier? You got it. All right, buckle up, gang. The subject of our rock and roll autopsy tonight will be Rock Me Tonight by 80s MTV rock casualty Billy Squier. We'll get the show started after these very important messages from our sponsors.
What's up, music nerds? Are you tired of wading through a sea of mediocre music, desperately seeking to find a glimmer of greatness? You're in luck. My name is Mark, and I am the host of the podcast, Songs That Don't Suck. Each week, I scour the depths of new music playlists to unearth hidden gems that defy the trends and deliver pure sonic bliss. No matter the genre, if it doesn't suck, it's on my radar. So find us on your favorite podcast platform and subscribe today. And as always, keep searching for and listening to Songs That Don't Suck.
Breaking news!
What is this garbage you're watching?
I want to watch the news!
This is the news.
Alright, gang, we've got our intrepid rock and roll beat reporter on the line, Rico motherfucking Gnu with the Gnu's. Rico, how are you?
Man, it's like, as of this recording, it's like, what, three or four or five days since Thanksgiving, and I'm just now coming down off my sugar high from all the fucking pie and baked goods and shit that I ate that day. It's taken me that long to come down from it, but other than that, I'm pretty good. How about you?
I enjoyed some pie myself, dude.
So speaking of pie, I got to let everybody know real quick, this whole get off my lawn Bitterman thing bit that you put on.
Get off my lawn.
I want everybody to know that that's not a bit. That's real. And the way that you all out there can know that Scott's Bitterman wet blanket thing is actually not fake. His favorite pie is pecan. Okay. And let me just put that into perspective. Nobody under the age of 70 should even know what that is, let alone it be their favorite pie. So the fact that pecan pie is Scott's favorite ought to tell you everything that you need to know about his get off my lawnedness. So I just had to get that out. It was bothering me.
Guilty as charged. And I ate over Thanksgiving. I had a slice of pecan pie blueberry pie, chocolate cream pie,
holy mackerel,
cheese cake.
So I started my day. I had a piece of cheesecake and a piece of tiramisu and a piece of carrot cake for breakfast. And then after my two plates of Thanksgiving, I had some apple pie, a piece of pumpkin pie, and a lemon nothing bundt cakes. You ever have those?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I had a lemon one after I had my pumpkin and apple pie with some vanilla Häagen-Dazs ice cream, by the way.
Good call.
And then right before I went to bed, I had the other piece of cheesecake with the creme brulee. So it was a very productive day for me.
Much thanks to give. All right, Rico. What's in the news, my man?
We haven't talked about this, I don't think, out in the open. In your pantheon of music movies, where does Spinal Tap like land for you? Honestly.
Oh my goodness, what a great question. It's gotta be up there, man. I've seen it a million times. It's one of the most quotable movies ever. All those guys involved are freaking geniuses, hysterical dudes. The other stuff that they do, like
the Mighty Wind and the dog show one. I can't remember that one.
But. Yep. All good shit. So yeah, this is Spinal Tap. It's got to be a top. I mean, it's got to be at the top of the list, right?
Oh, for sure. And part two of that question is there anybody that makes better comedies than Rob Reiner? Like, really, when you think about it, I mean, few, maybe there are, but he's right up there. Don't you think?
Agree.
So next year, fucking Spinal Tap sequel's coming out. It's been all over the news. I'm pretty pumped about it, but I want to ask you, first of all, are you excited about it? And second of all, my other question is kind of in the theme of this podcast, should they even be doing this? Go.
Well, Rico, I don't even know why I'm going to bother answering, since you started the podcast off saying that I'm a curmudgeon, get off my lawn. The fact
you
of
wear,
the matter
you wear, is, you wear that proudly, though. Come on.
Well, but I mean, it makes me somewhat predictable at this point. I mean, shockingly, I love this as Spinal Tap. If they're going to make a sequel, whatever. I mean, the guys are all 100 years old right now. I don't really need to see that. But if there's people out there who want to see it, I can't begrudge them the right to spend their $15 and go sit and watch it. But I don't have any interest in seeing it. And I'm not entirely certain that if it were up to me, you would never make a sequel to Spinal Tap. But every movie is going to be rebooted and sequeled at some point. So it was only a matter of time, I suppose.
I'm kind of torn on this because I just watched Princess Bride a few days ago, another Rob Reiner movie. I think Rob Reiner is a brilliant movie maker. I feel the same way about Spinal Tap as you do, that it's very much up there in the pantheon of movies in general. But yeah, I'm torn on this one because sequels generally suck. Like, there's only been a few that have been really great. Godfather Part II, Empire Strikes Back, in my opinion, are really the only two good ones that I can think of off the top of my head. If we go in the whole, you know, forest of moviedom out there, the odds are that this movie's not going to be good. These got like you're to your point, they're all old. I mean, they're all very funny, very, very comedically, intellectually geniuses. I feel that very strongly. But on the other hand, I want to be excited about this and I want to go see it, but then the realist in me says no, because it's going to blow and don't go see it. So I'm kind of in the middle on this one. I'm leaning towards what you're saying about this, that it's going to suck and that I'm not going to go see it.
I think it'll be good. It's in good hands. I mean, Rob Reiner is doing it. He's reprising his role in it. You're going to have Harry Shearer in it and all the gang will be back. I mean, I think it will be good. It'll be well done. I'm sure it'll be done with tremendous care. It's just for me, it's the same reason why I don't care about the Beatles song. It's to me, these things are not, there are no time machines. They don't exist. You can't travel time. So as much as we want to kind of keep reliving the things that we enjoyed again and again and again, sometimes things just fall under the category of you had to be there. And I think this is Spinal Tap had its moment in time and it was glorious. And that time is kind of like a thing that exists and it's past, and trying to recapture that isn't really going to work. I will say they put out a CD a couple years ago called Break Like the Wind or something. It was a, yes, you know, a fart like joke.
Breaking Like the Wind or something like
something
that.
Something like that. I bought it, of course. I bought it. It was like, it was, I think it was around the time my first kid was born. So it was like maybe 13 years ago this thing came out. I bought it. The world didn't care. The world didn't care that Spinal Tap put out new music. I barely cared. I think I listened to it like once. I think I bought it just out of like I had to, but I don't know, man. Here's
can
what we just leave it in the past.
Yeah, but this is what gives me hope, dude. The premise is it's the 40th anniversary of the band and they're a bunch of old farts doing their last tour. So it, that kind of gives me hope because they're going to lean heavily into why they shouldn't be doing this, which is why they're doing it, which gives me hope that it's going to be good because they're kind of breaking their own fourth wall while breaking the fourth wall, if that makes sense. So that gives me hope that it's actually going to be good and worth it because they're leaning into every reason why they shouldn't be doing it. So I don't know, man. I hope that it's good. I want it to be good. So I guess we'll see. Speaking of like movies, TVs or whatever, did you know that they're coming out with a new episode of Golden Girls?
No.
Did I tell you this?
Yeah, Betty White's dead.
No, I know, but in this episode, Ozzy bitches about Geezer Butler not calling him during his illness. Did you know that this episode is coming up?
Wow, do tell. I'm excited.
Yeah, so Ozzy Osbourne, if there's any indication that rock and roll is dead, Scott, it's when you think of Black Sabbath, man, come on. When you think of Sabbath, what do you think of? Come on, just the first thing that pops into your brain.
Birth of heavy metal, Prince of Darkness, the occult, doomy riffs,
Prince
really
of Darkness,
thick.
Mountains of Coke, cool, yes. Guitar riffs, right? Yep.
Yes.
You don't think of a couple of little old biddies bitching at each other over whether or not you called me while I was sick, right? That's not what comes to mind, right?
It is certainly not. You are
there,
right.
There are a couple of old blue hairs now. Ozzy Osbourne's like, Geezer Butler didn't call me. I fucking called him and he didn't call me. And Geezer Butler's like, I sent you an email. I sent your email because I didn't have your phone number and Sharon didn't get back to me. And then I tried one more time and they didn't get back to me. So I tried. So quit your bitching. It's laughable, dude. Like, I feel like this should be on television or something. Like, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, I can't find any fault with any. I think you've laid it out beautifully, and you are 1,000% right. This is exactly what kills rock and roll. When Ozzy Osbourne will be on the Mount Rushmore of heavy metal, and when this is what he's become, where he's complaining that Geezer Butler didn't call him while he was sick, it's like nobody wants to. I don't want to see this crap. It's bad enough I got to walk him, you know, watch him walk around with Kane and being propped up on stage with that like device that they snapped onto his back like he's a human Lego just to stand him up on stage. Rico, you are 1,000% correct. And then Geezer responds back. And did you read what Geezer said? He said it's actually the wives. He blamed it on his wife and Sharon because the wives don't get along. And
yeah, they're beefing, and then they're sabotaging the relationship because they're beefing, right?
Yeah. So instead of like taking responsibility for his own shit, he's like, "Well, it's the wives. My wife won't let me talk to him, and his wife won't let him." It's
oh my god,
the worst, dude.
Jesus, don't they have like? This is interrupting their bingo sessions or some kind of shit, dude. Listen, Paige Gregory, I know you listen to this. this is why rock is dead, Paige. Prove me wrong. Tell me why I'm wrong, Paige. I know you're listening right now. This is why rock is dead.
Oh my gosh, that's hilarious, dude. Yeah, well, I mean, and to Geezer's credit, Geezer has actually retired. He stopped dyeing his hair. It's all white. He let a big old belly come on him. He's accepting life as a septuagenarian. It's just with his grandkids in Vegas, getting fat and old. Ozzy is fighting it tooth and nail, and the dude can hardly walk at this point. He's got Parkinson's. He's in a bad way. Just accept. Go be with your grandkids, age gracefully.
Dude, Geezer's leaning into his name finally, right?
He's doing what now?
Geezer's leaning into his name finally, apparently, right? It only took him 50 years to finally live up to it, I suppose.
Oh my gosh.
Oh God, I don't know. Anyway, one more quick one. So are you aware Ace's new album, 10,000 Volts? You know it's coming out?
Dude, I saw the teaser the other day on Instagram of it was a riff and like a video cut. I saw the album cover. And then today you sent me a link to the song. And of course, unlike the Beatles, I want to hear what Ace Frehley's up to now. That's fun. I went right to it and streamed it a couple times. Hell yeah, I did.
What'd you think of those sweet ass 40-year-old guitar licks, man? They're in there too. What do you think of them, dude? He is not reinventing the wheel at all, and I love every minute of it, right?
It ends, Rico, with a fade out. Something else that hasn't been done in rock music in a million years.
It's a beautiful thing, man. And you know what? Good on him because this album is dedicated to Paul Stanley. Those guys are wrapping it up. They haven't made new music in, I don't know, when's the last time they put out a new album, dude?
It was that Monster record. It's been a minute, yeah.
Ace Frehley is still putting out new music. He's giving them a big, giant F you. And here's the funny part about this. Like, I know he said, I will not play the final show because they haven't called me. And you know what that sounds like? That sounds like he's got the phone right next to his ear waiting for a phone call. Like it's like John Bender from Breakfast Club, right? That's a total John Bender move. Like he's got the phone in hand, staring at it, waiting for Paul to call him, man. But he's like, no, I'm not answering the phone call. I don't want to play your stupid show. Can they call me? I wish they called me. Can they call me, please? It's silly, but I love the fact that he's got a new album coming out. The song's awesome, man. It's totally Ace. The licks are there. It's beautiful, man. The fade out, to your point, it's amazing. Yeah,
I do like the song. It's formulaic as hell. He's not reinventing the wheel, but somehow when I hear a new Ace Frehley song or any, I like solo Ace Frehley. I always have. It's a guilty pleasure for me. I enjoy it. I like the Ace Kiss songs. I like Kiss, period. But I like the Ace Kiss songs. I'm liking it. Count me in. I'll stay until midnight and listen to it like I did the Roger Waters.
Hell yeah. You put it good. Like Ace solo Ace is a guilty pleasure. It's like you almost feel like you shouldn't like it.
Oh, totally. It's
like cheesecake, dude. It's like pecan pie. There's no way on this planet that you should like that stuff, but you do. Yeah. And it's amazing. By the way, I love pecan pie also, so don't let my bit fool you all. It's really great pie. But it's kind of like that kind. It's like baked goods. You're not supposed to like them, but you do, and you feel bad because you like it. That's Ace. That's solo Ace, right?
You know, like a year ago, Ace played a gig at the Kent stage.
How did I not know about
that? I know. It was in December, too. It was like literally a year ago.
I could have walked there.
Yeah, but if those are the types of places he's playing and he ever comes around again, my understanding of what an Ace Frehley live show looks like is that Ace's, this is a comedy / music commentary podcast. Everything is allegedly, reportedly, this is all in jest.
It's for entertainment purposes. There's nothing factual or big giant disclaimer that's out there. Okay, so go ahead.
Thank you, Rico. Ace has deteriorating skills, and his cognitive abilities, if you've watched any interview with him, are clearly on the decline, okay? And if you've seen him play guitar, I've seen him play guitar in like interviews, just noodling. And Ace didn't have like a ton of skill in the 1970s. He had enough to be the lead guitar player in Kiss. But Ace in 2023, holy hell. I mean, he's barely holding on. When you go see Ace Frehley live, he has a great backing band, and they are the hardest working backing band in showbiz because they prop his ass up every single night and make him sound good. They're covering for him night after night. So when you go see a live Ace show, you're really seeing his backing band and Ace on stage kind of working his way as best he can through the songs. But pull it up on YouTube if you don't believe me. But allegedly, reportedly, I just think that in my estimation, Ace's skills have, but somehow he worked with a writer. He worked with, who did he work with on this record? I want to say Steve Brown from Trickster, who has become quite the, kind of the session guy since Trickster folded many decades ago. I think he wrote a lot of this record with Steve Brown, which means Steve Brown wrote the record. Allegedly, reportedly. I'm just talking shit here on a comedy music commentary podcast. None of this is
good. We're not making sense to ourselves, let alone to any of you out there. So don't worry about it.
Thank you. So I think, all I'm saying is I'll just put that out there.
Okay, so one final question. If he comes around to say Kent Stage, should we think about going or not?
I think that's a definitive yes, because I think it could be a little bit like, you know how Corey Feldman does the shows and people just go because it's a train wreck? Now, Ace's shows are not a train wreck. Ace puts on, he has a professional backing band that
makes
him sound really, really good. So
to use an Northeast Ohio term, so what you're saying is we would be going to rubberneck that show, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I mean, Ace is a legend. You know, he's a legend. He's in the Rock Hall. He's a Hall of Famer, but he's also a guy in his 70s who, in my opinion, hasn't seriously. Practiced or kept up with his skills on the instrument. And I think if you pull up literally any YouTube video of him just playing guitar, that is not the guy who played on those Kiss records in the 70s. There's some serious diminishing skills. So I think that, this is brutal. Why am I doing this? I think that these records, as much as I enjoy the music, I think there's a lot of help on these things.
Well, certainly, dude. I mean, that's... he's selling the sizzle just right about now. He's all about the sizzle and not very much about the steak, right?
Rico, it's Kiss is always Kiss and all the appendages of Kiss.
It's always been about the sizzle.
Yes, Kiss has always been a brand before they're a band. This band has been selling shit sandwiches for decades now, and people buy it because of the brand.
How do you feel bad for saying that when it's been like that for 45, 50 years now?
But I do enjoy Ace's stuff, and I really sincerely do. But I also, when I see him play, it's a lot of that Kirk Hammett thing. Now I'm going to trash Kirk Hammett. What is wrong with me? It's a lot of that thing where I see a guy who's maybe not putting the work into his craft. You know what I mean?
Ode to John and his hatred of Kirk Hammett. Anyways. Enough about that. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Scott, we're going to talk about a song. Holy shit. It went from one end of the spectrum to the other and just fucking shook Billy Squire's world, dude. So stick around. We'll be right back.
Looking for a good rock and roll book? Do you watch a ton of rock and roll documentaries like I do? Well, that's why I started the Rock Talk Studio podcast, to be the place to go for previews, reviews, and recommendations of rock and roll books, documentaries, and movies. Every first Tuesday of the month, the Rock Talk Studio gets you caught up on all the latest and points out where to go for the good stuff. Give me 20 minutes and I'll get you caught up on the world of rock and roll books, docs, and movies from every possible angle and leave you with a no-doubt decision on where to spend your time and money. fan or just casual fan, or maybe you're on the fence and just looking for something new to check out, either way, I got you covered. Recently on the show, I've talked about books and documentaries from everyone and everything from David Bowie, Randy Rhoads, and the Allman Brothers, to the Abbey Road Studios, Cheap Trick, Stevie Ray Vaughan, Little Richard, and more. Join me, Big Rick, every Tuesday of the month as I host the Rock Talk Studio podcast, the ultimate review of rock and roll books, documentaries, and movies.
Our Mind on Music is a podcast that covers all things music. We cover all genres, and we welcome all perspectives, from musicians, producers, and content creators to music enthusiasts. We have discussions, interviews, opinions, and much, much more. We hope you'll join us every week, Our Mind on Music, on YouTube and all streaming platforms.
We are gathered here to remember rock and roll. Rock was born the rambunctious son of country, western, and blues. In the year of our Lord, 1955. On this day, the birth of rock and roll gifted under the world a gyrating pelvis, a throbbing beat, and a pulsating rhythm. A sound so infectious and rollicking that it would endow previously scrupulous young minds with identity, individualism, and purpose, thus setting forth a multi-generational pursuit of all that is loud, debaucherous, and unholy. But, sadly, like all earthly endeavors, rock too must perish. Oh, we mourn the loss of rock and roll, with its ridiculously old standard bearers still on tour and charging ungodly amounts of Mad Jack to witness their long past the sell-by date asses on stage, and with its chauvinism, misogyny, and whiteness no longer aligning with modern sensibilities, and with its aging, fist-shaking fan base kicking every would-be rocker off their proverbial lawn, rock has indeed passed into the celestial void. May rock rest in peace in eternal cacophonous slumber. Amen.
Thank you for that, Scott.
You are listening to the Rock and Roll Autopsy Podcast.
The Autopsy Report.
All right, ladies and germs, hey, thanks for listening. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for sticking around. If you like what you hear, go grab somebody and make them listen. I think they'll like it too. Anyways, dude, Rock Me Tonight by Billy fucking Squire, dude. This song, I have to be honest with you, for a while now, this has been in the bowels of my psyche, looking forward to talking about this song. This song was a whirlwind for Billy Squire for a couple of different reasons. We're going to get into that. So yeah, dude, this song came out once again, 1984, dude. Was there any good music in 1984?
Just a little,
a few good things, right? So this came out in 1984. It's off the album Signs of Life. It's a little bit longer, dude. It's almost 5 minutes. Crazy, right? Capitol Records. Billy Squire wrote the song, and looks like, I can't fucking read. Jim Steinman and Billy Squire produced it. Dude, Rock Me Tonight. Did it kill rock? Maybe it killed Billy Squire's career too, but we'll get into that. But did it kill rock? We're going to find out.
Thank you, Rico. You rock, sir. All right, gang. It's Rock and Roll Autopsy. This is the autopsy portion of the show. We've delivered to you the news, which tonight doubled as, I don't know, I felt like I was at the old people's home, like, you know, like eating that, you know how they do that funny, you ever go visit anyone in the old people's home? You ever do that? Kind of sad.
I've done that before. It's sad.
You see like the lunch menu, and it always kills me how they'll put, like, when they put the food, they'll count like condiments as like part of the meal.
I know,
you know, like it'll say pat of butter.
It's funny, but it's true in a really not fun way.
I know. Anyway, when you think of like all the gluttony that you and I, the display that we put on over Thanksgiving, and there's people who have lived a long time living in an old person's home, and literally their lunch menu says pat of butter. Anyway, I digress. But that was what the news segment felt like. My goodness, Rico, is this where rock is? Where it was a great news segment, but my gosh, we got two old men fighting. We've got diminishing skills. We've got a movie for a retelling of a story from 40 years ago. Holy hell.
This is where we are, man. Rock is dead, and we're just talking about it. We didn't kill rock. We're just telling people about it. We didn't do this. Didn't kill rock.
We've been supporters,
right? We wanted to carry on, but we're only two people. We can only do so much.
Heaven help us. Well, all right, let's carve this bad boy up. This is Rock and Roll Autopsy. The song Rock Me Tonight by Billy Squire. My goodness. Where to begin?
I know.
All right. How do we do this? We've got proprietary science on our side. It consists of five scientifically proven and tested over 102 amazing episodes. Go back and listen to them all. Our numbers have been in the toilet for about a month now. I'm guessing all y'all just checked out for the year and are like doing family
Could
shit.
Be.
I don't know.
Could be.
But if you feel the need to go back and look at some of these songs and see what went wrong, get an idea of what this podcast is all about, please do it. Rock and roll off.
But feel free to skip the Love Gun episode.
Oh, yes. Nice disclaimer. Thank you. Rock and Roll Autopsy. We've got five categories. They are gratuitous boomerism, excessive misogyny, wanton whiteness, malignant machismo, and culture vulturism. The artist, Billy Squire, the album, Signs of Life, the year, the amazing 1984. The track is called Rock Me Tonight. The category is gratuitous boomerism. Rico, where do you stand?
Oh my God. Wow, dude. Boomerism. The subject matter of the song is not exactly boomerism. It transfers. We'll get into the meaning of the song. The style of the song, kind of that early 80s pop rock thing that everybody was changed. Like even Rush did it. Everybody stopped, you know, with the exception of the California guys like Motley Crue and all those guys, Van Halen, with the exception of that group. Man, this pop rock thing was just taking the entire music world by storm, and Billy Squire jumped on that boat, and we'll get into that. But man, I have to feel like just because he rode that train like everybody else, I gotta give him a 0.5 on this one. I don't really have a good reason why, but that's just what I'm doing. Science, well, that's why.
I think there's plenty of science here to be had. For one thing, our man Billy Squire is born in 1950. He's 73 years old now.
Oh, well, that's the obligatory 0.5 right there.
Yeah, so he is a boomer. And in reading about this song, and I did a bit of reading on it and actually watched a couple of YouTube videos because there's no shortage of information. I doubt, dear listener, that Rico and I are going to shed any new light on this. Only we're going to be the only ones putting it under these five categories of scientific criticism. But there are a number of articles and even books, one of which we'll mention, and YouTube content surrounding this song. And the one thing that strikes me that is kind of boomerific, and listen, I'm going to give it a one. He's a boomer. But the one thing that strikes me as being kind of boomerific, and I don't want to paint an entire generation broadly, but I guess I'm about to. But let me preface it by saying, I love boomers. I know boomers are not popular in the culture now. I love them. I was raised by boomers. I've got all my heroes were boomers. They really were. All the people I grew up admiring, whether it was David Letterman or any number of rock stars that are all aging out now, they were all boomers, right? Every comedian I ever loved. So I'm a fan, Boomers, but in reading about this song, I'll get to the point. A lot of the Sturm and Drang around the video, it seems to me, centered around the idea that he looked, and for anybody who doesn't know, pull the video up. You'll see Billy Squier dancing alone in a bedroom wearing pastels and satin sheets. But a lot of what made people uncomfortable about the video and made it the career killer that it was, yeah, was kind of the not so coded homosexuality around all of it, right? That the idea that he was dancing, like, in the eyes of the people of that generation, he looked gay, and that was bad.
That's right. That's right. And that's the whole crux of this whole thing. The premise behind the video, it was supposed to be like this in the spirit of Richard Gere, American Gigolo. It was supposed to be in the spirit of that, right? This hotel with, but he's wearing this like loose pink, you know, let's face it. Back then I had a pink tank top also, but sure, I wasn't frolicking around a hotel bedroom like he was. And yes, the thing that killed this is that was all the overtly and not so covertly overtly homophobic like tidal wave that ran through everything back then. Everybody was home. If you were gay, it was bad. The homophobic tones and that were involved with this was just a killer for him. And it wasn't on purpose. I read articles about it too. From what I read, he was just like letting her rip, just dancing around, just kind of feeling it, right? And it didn't turn out so good. But anyway, go ahead.
Well, thank you. I think though, this is where the perspective of the people at that time, that generation, rejected it, because in rock music, it was this hyper hetero macho music, mostly dominated by men on the charts. And then you have a guy who's not gay, by the way, but looked, how to word it, looked effeminate in the way he was dancing in the room and the overall aesthetic of the video. And that just by looking effeminate, it damaged his career because it turned the audience off so much.
I kind of have a little bit of a theory as to why people had so much of a problem with this particular video, because let's face it, nobody had a, even guys, Scott, nobody had a problem with George Michael. Nobody had a problem with Boy George. Why? Because they did Freddie Mercury, those guys, nobody had a problem with those guys because they were so, there wasn't a question about whether or not they were gay, right? Boy George, perfect example. Nobody ever had a problem with his videos or his songs. He was extremely popular. I think his music was pretty cool. And I know a lot of people who thought his music was pretty cool. He never got hammered for being gay. But I think the difference with Billy Squier is before this video, like think of The Stroke, think of Emotions in Motion, think of his other songs were super dude, sexual, macho songs, right? And so everybody already had this image about who Billy Squier is, and they wanted to be a part of that. Like The Stroke was badass. Like if you were a dude, you wanted to play that in front of your chick while you were having sex with her, right? Because it was a macho sexual song, right? And so you bought in, you were a dude and you bought into Billy Squier and his sexual macho-ness, right? And then this video comes out and it just gives, like, you bought into a dude, and now this video gives you such cognitive dissonance that people just pushed it away. And I think because of where he started to where this video wound up, I think that was a big part of it.
Yeah, I'm going to score that a one. Good points, Rico. Let's move on. Category two, excessive misogyny. And Rico, I have the lyrics available if you need to hear some of the lyrics to Billy Squier's Rock Me Tonight.
Please do. And this spoken word is brought to you by the Cock Cap. No more embarrassing dribbles. By the Cock Cap.
I'm rocking tonight, I'm walking on air. Gonna find me some trouble. Gonna grab my share. I want ya tonight. I want ya with me. Make me guilty of love in the first degree. You want it all right. We're going in style. Say you walk right, you talk right, and your hair's so wild. Snow White, hey, that's not what I mean. We go down in the shadows and crawl between. Moonlight in the city brings the magic to your eyes. Freeze in a moment, leave me paralyzed. Breathe an emotion, set it dancing in my ear. Bring on the rhythm when I hold you near. Take me in your arms, roll me through the night. Take me in your heart. Take me to your heart. Rock me tonight. Do you need any more lyrics, Rico?
No, I'm good. Thanks. So at first you kind of are given a false sense of machismo with the verse, you know, but then when we get to the chorus, then he's like, take me in your arms. Hold me like that. He totally flips the script, and the verse makes it seems like he's taking control of the scenario, right? But then when we get to the chorus, then he completely flips the script and puts everything, the ball completely in her court. And so I can't give it a full one, but I have to give it a 0.5 because the verse kind of takes you down that road, but then the chorus kind of steers you back a little bit. So I'm going to go 0.5 on this one.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, man. I'm not really seeing anything in this one. It just seems like it's not so much an overt kind of horn dog song. It's not. It strikes me even as if these people could be like a couple. Like, it's not even a one night stand. They might just be lovers that have like an ongoing thing, and they're just, you know, looking forward to, you know, he's longing for her, and she will, you know, take him when the time comes. And
yeah,
you know,
I agree.
Pretty safe stuff. I mean, the lyrics aren't bad. You know,
not at all.
There's some poetry at work. It's pretty. I mean, we're not breaking new ground here. This is about as trite kind of in terms of like rock lyricism as you could get, you know, the basic, you know, we're looking to get laid kind of thing. It would almost benefit the song if it was more misogynistic, because at least it would be more interesting. But because it's just kind of like,
seems a little nice, right?
It does. Yeah.
It's a little vanilla and a little nice for it to be machismo, right?
It's almost like it could be like one of those primetime like cop shows. Like, it could be the theme to it, you know, one of those 80s like Hill Street Blues kind of. Listen to this verse. Moonlight in the city brings the magic to your eyes. Freeze in a moment, leave me paralyzed. I mean, that's like
if this were on TV, it'd be on the Hallmark Channel or something, you know.
It feels like an 80s like primetime cop drama kind of thing that he's painting. Like one of those kind of deals. I don't know, man. It's very safe. It would almost be more interesting if it broke a few barriers. But I think by the time Billy Squier got to this record, the stated purpose was to explore some poppier territory, some poppier sounds. The song utilizes a lot of pop elements in it. Yep. It's a really well-written song. It's a good song. It's a shame about the video because it is a good song.
Yeah, dude, don't forget. In 1984, with all of the great music in that year that we've talked about, this song hit number one in 1984.
That's incredible. Yeah, that's incredible. It's a great track. I mean, it is safe, though. I mean, it's not, you know, he had earlier tracks that were a little more rocking. And like, to your point, this, I think, is intended for broader appeal. And earlier he was going after a 14-year-old, you know, white male audience, I think. Yeah. And this is, he's going for some broader appeal. And I think for the large part, it's successful. I'm going to score it a 0, though. I'm not seeing any. Let's move on to category 3. Wanton Whiteness. Billy Squier, Rock Me Tonight. Rico, how do you score?
You know, I have to be honest. I mean, I feel like the message of the song is not exactly white per se. But the style of music is super white. The video is ridiculously cracker white. And I know it doesn't matter if he intended it to be that way or not. It's fucking white as fuck, dude. And the style of music is white as fuck.
Really? Yep.
I gotta give it. I'm giving this one a full on one. Full on 1.0 for sure.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, you kind of wondered out loud, why were some artists allowed to explore, you know, androgyny or maybe be effeminate and get away with it in 1984? You cited Boy George. I don't think George Michael was out yet, as ridiculous as like the Wham video was. I don't think he was out yet. It may have been known.
I don't think so. But
I don't think he was out whenever Faith came out. I think he came out publicly like after that, you know, but it may have been known in like music circles, but his broader fan base, I don't think really knew.
No, I don't think so. And there were other acts too, like other of that kind of like, what am I thinking of, that pop alternative, where there was a lot of androgynous male artists.
Even early Bowie, but I mean
that exactly, and none of them got flack for being androgynous or effeminate, was my point. There was plenty of them.
So why does it happen to Billy Squier? Now, some of those artists I think are pop, and I do think pop gets a lot more latitude than rock does, because I think rock lives in this space where it's like this masculine kind of space. Times have changed. We have more women in rock now, but at that time, and that's part of why this podcast exists, it was dominated by, for the vast history of rock music, white men. And yeah, so it did have this kind of, because he was like firmly kind of rooted in that rock element, that seeing him in the full-on pastel flash dance thing would have been jarring. But I'm going to score this a 0.5. He's a white guy. It's a super white song. But the one thing, it kind of gets overlooked, and I found an article here that points it out, and I'll just read it. Billy Squier is still relevant today. He's one of the most sampled artists in hip-hop history, thanks to a series of rhythm tracks by the late drummer Bobby, I'm going to butcher the last name, I'm sorry, Bobby. Bobby Chouinard, I'm not sure how to say it. Chouinard, look it up. Eminem has sampled Billy Squier's song, and the singer's 1980 classic, The Big Beat, is one of the most sampled songs of all time. Legendary rapper Big Daddy Kane says, Billy Squier is definitely someone who helped mold and shape hip-hop with his music. I would put him in the category of James Brown, the Honey Drippers, and Chic. So Billy Squier, as odd as it would seem for this cracker-ass rock artist who was taken down by a music video of all things, had a tremendous influence on hip-hop, which is like firmly ensconced in African-American culture. Not necessarily this song, but I'm going to score him a 0.5 for being a white guy and a soft 0.5 for having influenced hip hop.
Well, and that's what I'm saying. Like the stuff that he did before this song, like think of it, think of the groove and some of the, like the stroke, think of the groove on that song, thinking the groove on the song, emotion, doon, those songs had a fucking sweet groove. And there was a lot of sexual macho machismo in those songs. In this song, and especially the video, the song by itself was very popular and gigantic and huge and totally successful, but this video, to your point, was such a shocker, and it went in such on the other end of the spectrum that I think it just like shook people's brains up, because the previous stuff was so groovy and macho. So I don't know, dude,
I'm going to go 0.5. Let's move on. Since you mentioned macho, maybe that's a nice segue into our next category.
Yep.
Malignant machismo. Rico, how do you score?
Well, I mean, if you take the song by itself, no, because I mean, like I said, the song is safe. It's really nice. It's very pop rocky, which is not very machismo. It's got this nice little synthesizer in there, which is not very machismo in this context anyways. Then you have the video with him dancing around in the pink tank top and the silk sheets, which really there's nothing wrong with that. But in the context of what we're talking about, there wound up being a lot wrong with it. So, I mean, for malignant machismo, it has to be a zero for malignant machismo, right?
Yeah, I agree. I'm scoring it a zero as well. A couple other things to mention. Yeah. Here. I don't see this is, I mean, this is a, I don't know how we can score it anything other than a zero when the main slag of the time on the video for the song is how effeminate it was.
Yeah.
At least in how it makes him appear. So in 2011, a book came out called I Want My MTV, and it's all about the history and oral history of the network's early years. And over 400 people, primarily artists, managers, filmmakers, and record company executives, and MTV employees were interviewed for this book. And only they couldn't agree on anything. They couldn't agree on the best video. But of those 400, they all agreed the worst was Rock Me Tonight. Only one video has an entire chapter in that book devoted to it, and that's Rock Me Tonight. To say this video took down this man's career, in a modern kind of lens, it would be the modern equivalent of a viral video taking somebody down. You know, someone loses their shaboinkle in a McDonald's. You know, like we see these videos of people like we see there. You know, there's some guy who yells at some kids in his driveway, drops the N-word a few times, and next thing you know, his employer's firing him. You know what I mean? Because it goes viral.
Yep.
This stuff happens all the time. Yep. This is like the 1984 equivalent of a viral video. They pulled and tried to kill this thing so fast after it hit the airwaves, but the damage was done so quickly that it literally to this day, it's infamous for how quickly and how negatively the backlash was to it. It just brings to mind the effect that viral videos have today on people.
Yeah, for sure. Now to put it in even more context, remember, like I said, between 1980 and 1984, Billy Squier was gigantic. He was huge. He was unbelievably popular. And this also goes to show you just how influential and powerful MTV was back then. MTV, Scott, everybody watched MTV. Everybody wanted to be on MTV. Every famous person on the planet wanted to say, I want my MTV in front of a camera in those little 5-second spots. MTV made people and MTV broke people. And as popular and as huge as Billy Squier was, this video eliminated him in 1 minute.
Oh, beautifully put. I was going to say something along those lines, but you eloquently did it for me. I'm reading from an article called from Onstage Magazine called Billy Squier's Career Killing Video by Jack Bren, June 18th, 2017. That's where I got those earlier lines. Yeah, I agree totally, Rico. Well put. Let's move on to culture vulturism, our final category for Rock Me Tonight by Billy Squier. Rico, how do you score?
Yeah, he did what everybody was doing. He went away from what put him on the map and he went the pop rock route. And although this album went platinum, which it did, and although this song hit number one in 1984, which is incredible. no small feat in that year, which we've talked about many times. He inevitably, being the artistic sheep that he was and followed the trend, wound up killing his career. For that alone, he gets a one for me.
Yeah, I think that's really well put. And it's actually exactly what I wanted to touch on in this category is the idea of when you try to hop onto trends, whether they're in fashion or music, even in sports, when teams copy the successes of one another, it can sometimes go sideways on you. You know what I mean? And we see this. you know, and this is an instance where for culture vulturism, it's a one. This entire album is centered around the idea of going a little more pop. You're intentionally trying to appease and reach out to and attract a larger audience. So you're playing it a little more down the middle. You're adopting styles that maybe aren't what you've made your bones on doing. So you're admittedly co-opting other flavors and ideas and influences with the intended goal of attracting a wider audience. And you're also embracing this video technology, which in 1984, MTV was still really new and exploding in popularity and making really big artists. It hadn't broken one yet. He would be the first. But the idea is that sometimes whenever you latch on to a trend because you're trying to either expand your audience or try something new or stay relevant, like Kiss with Dynasty, right? Whenever they did I Was Made for Loving You, they blatantly co-opted the disco thing. Great track. I love it, but they lost fans over it, right? This is not dissimilar. And it's one of those things where it's a cautionary tale that sometimes it's best to kind of like be true to who you are rather than trying to adopt things, especially newer things. And the music video era was still pretty new at that time. And you really hadn't, you know, you kind of need to let someone else, you know, take their lumps first, I guess. But whenever you go out there and adopt something new, if you're an early adopter, there are some risks that can be involved with that. You know, a lot of those guys, a lot of those 70s artists especially had like no experience doing videos. And when they started making videos, look at those old Judas Priest videos. They were ridiculous. They were 70s artists. These guys weren't guys that were comfortable in front of the camera, you know? It reminds me a little bit of like, we talk about AI a lot at my job now. And I can remember it, and it's always about like, you have to wait a little bit to adopt things, to wait for kind of like the ethics of it to play out. Like I've been doing what I do for a long time. And I can remember 20 years ago when people were, quote, airbrushing everything, right? We were whitening teeth, we were removing wrinkles, we were fixing love handles. We were doing all of that because we had the technology to do it and we were encouraged to do it, you know? And so it was called airbrushing, it was really photoshopping, right? So the tech was there, so we were going to town on it. Well, now there's a huge backlash against all of that. This happened maybe like a decade ago. The worm kind of turned on it and it was like, you know what? When you do that stuff, it sets up unrealistic expectations for especially young women about body image. It's incredibly damaging to people's self-esteem. People don't really look like that. It's dishonest. And so just because you have the tech to do it, maybe don't. And we talk about that with AI. We got to let the ethics of it kind of work themselves out a little bit before we dive in whole hog. Otherwise, it's a cautionary tale. Sometimes things can go sideways on you and you find yourself like Billy Squier with a promising career that now is dead in the water because he made a really ill-advised music video. If he didn't do it, someone would have back then.
Yep. Inevitably, you know? It had happened to somebody, but unfortunately, he was the guy.
He was the guy. So I'm scoring it a full-on one. It is a hardcore. It is the ultimate cautionary tale of culture vulturism.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Rico, what have you got, bud? Well, hold on. Let me tally mine up first.
Yeah, go ahead.
How we do it? I go first.
Yeah, you go first. Go ahead.
All right, I'm sorry. We've only done 102 of these.
It takes me longer to add my scores up anyways.
All right. Well, I've got a 2.5, Rico.
All right. 15. I've got 3.0.
For a grand total of 5.5. I think that's fair.
Yeah, that's totally fair because Scott, the song didn't kill rock. The video is the thing that caused all the damage.
Yeah.
So the song
killed him, not rock and roll.
Yeah. So the song landed exactly where it should have landed.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel bad for him, man. Boy, I watched that video a couple times, and let me tell you, man, that's a hard watch.
Even in, boy, if you watch that video with today's hat on and not your 1984 hat on, it's still uncomfortable to watch.
Yeah, yeah. It makes you wonder, like, what were our eyes like? There's a lot of stuff that you watch back then. It's really hard to watch. And it's like, how did our eyes not like catch this? Like, you know, the video I think is hard to watch is Separate Ways by Journey, where they're all playing the air guitar in front of the,
it was in front of the museum with,
they're like on a dock and like they keep getting, and they like aim their bodies right at the camera lens and they're like singing right at it and doing like air guitar.
Someday.
Yes.
Like he's doing this fist pump thing.
Yes.
I mean, it's a fantastic song, but holy
great Christ, song.
The video is really awkward.
Oh my gosh. But
but that was what was so great about MTV, man. Like they put this stuff on there and the people who were making these videos, like it was a new frontier. It was the wild, wild west,
yes,
so to speak. The only thing that you had to adhere to was network rules of what was appropriate. But as long as you fell within that umbrella, you could do whatever the fuck you wanted, man.
Yeah.
And it was so popular that people did some really weird shit as long as it was quote unquote appropriate. We all bought into it.
Yeah.
MTV was amazing, dude. I loved MTV.
But it took a couple years to get good. A lot of the early videos, you could tell the artist and their labels didn't know what the hell to do. A lot of performance videos. But then whenever like Van Halen, you know, David Lee Roth changed MTV quite a bit because he started like scripting things and adding comedy bits and mini movies. John Landis with Michael Jackson doing thrillers. Scorsese did Bad. All of a sudden it was like legitimized and these things became like real kind of like legitimate art form, you know.
Once we hit like the mid 80s is when it really was started getting really good.
I watched a YouTube video some guy did on the Rock Me Tonight video, and he said that they hadn't shot anything for it, and MTV was launching a world premiere in 2 weeks, and they already had it booked, and MTV had been promoting it, and the world premiere of the new Billy Squire song, and they hadn't shot Budkiss. They'd shot nothing. And Billy Squire had this vision for that American Gigolo thing that you talked about, that Richard Gere movie. Well, they had a guy who, I guess was directing it or did the choreography, but he saw Billy Squire on stage and said he did all these great dance moves on stage, but he always had a guitar in his hand and he'd be like swinging his hips and like clicking his fingers and doing a thing where he would, you know, he had all these wacky spins and shit that he would do on stage. And the guy says, well, just do that, but without the guitar.
Yeah, but the guitar is what made it macho and cool and not dumb. Like it wound up being.
Yeah. And the other thing is too, anytime you're a dude and you're like slithering along the floor on all fours and you're come hither sexy poses, Madonna could pull that off. Prince could pull that off. Billy Squire cannot pull that off.
No, he can't. He can't, Scott. He can't. Oh my God.
So
I guess what we're saying is this is a good song. Okay, it is. It's a good song. It was a popular song. The video, do me a favor, if they're all of you one or two people that are listening, go back and listen to some Billy Squire. I always liked Billy Squire. I always did, and he disappeared because of this video. But please do yourselves a favor, do me a favor, and go back and listen to some Billy Squire and experience just how cool this guy's music really was.
Yeah, it's good shit, man. It's definitely good, like, kind of, I would describe it as, like, pop rock of the time, you know, a little more rock in the early stuff. But, yeah, it's good shit, man.
I wouldn't go any later than this album, though. I would go between 80 and 84, I would hit that 4 year time period. I don't really give a shit about anything after this album, but it's up until this album that there's some really good stuff, man. There really is.
All right, Rico. Well, it's time to go hit up another slice of pie.
Absolutely. I'm my bloatiness is starting to go down and I need to puff it back up. So
yeah.
I got to hit the road.
All right, man. This has been Rock and Roll Autopsy. Good night now.
Let me have that special rock and roll music. Yeah!
Let me tell you, so the lyrics to real rock music is nothing more than satanic cyanide. Get it out of your house, throw it out, and burn it. It has no place in the house of the righteous.
You guys, it was like a mystique. There's no mystique anymore.
To the dawn, love it, hey, to the morning, I'm gone, I'm gone.
Follow us on Twitter at RNR Autopsy, or you can send an email to rockandrollautopsy@gmail.com, and if we run across anything good, we'll mention it in a future episode. Thanks for listening. Later.
Well, you know, that's just like your opinion, man.
Before you go, if you like heavy metal and stories, then you'll love Battle of the Bands, the narrative form metal podcast that unpacks the biggest rivalries in rock and metal history. Season 1 took in Megadeth versus Metallica, and Season 2 went across the divide to explore the beef between Judas Priest and Iron Maiden. It's like Business Wars, but metal. Find Battle of the Bands wherever you listen to your podcasts, or visit battleofthebandspod.com.